Just a note before we start the show, this was recorded back in May, so some of the scheduling and events we talk about are a little outdated, but the design contest is currently judging round two, so if you'd like to help out with judging for that, you can go to theboardgameworkshop.com and follow the links to the design contest to sign up to be a judge. On to the show. Welcome to the Board Game Workshop. I'm your host, Chris Anderson. I'm joined by Andrew Tulson, manager of Print and Play. So, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris.
For people that don't know you in the audience, why don't you give us just a short overview of how you got into the industry, what you do, how you got started with Print and Play, and just your story up to this point.
For sure. Yeah, so I have been running Print and Play for the past 12 years now or so. I started the company myself back when I was 16 in my parents' house in my bedroom, and I started just printing out free games that I could find online, and I realized that it was more efficient to buy paper in bulk and that other people would pay me to print out games for them, and things just kind of progressed from there. I jumped on Board Game Geek and started posting pictures of some of my builds and realized that I liked printing games more than I liked going to school. And so I eventually dropped out of school and started working on this full time. About 7 years ago or so, I sold my company to Ad Magic. And so rather than being the owner of Print and Play now, I am just the manager. But I'm pretty much doing exactly what I was doing before, managing the company, printing up games. Yeah, that is sort of the in short of the past 12 years of my life with Print and Play.
Wow, 12 years. I mean, that is a long time to be working on something. But I mean, obviously, a lot of designers are familiar with making prototypes. So what are some of the things you've done, especially at the beginning when you were still new to this? And I assume now you have more high-level machinery than when you started with. But what were some of the things that you first started with to make a prototype that was slightly better than what someone could do at home so that they would feel like paying you, although just the effort alone is worth paying someone to do.
And that's essentially the catch right there, is that when I started out, I honestly had a little tiny inkjet printer, like just like one of like the little tiny desktop ones that was honestly much worse than the ones that are available today. The main thing was, people back about 12 years ago, print and play games were just becoming more of a thing, and people were actually saying, hey, like, I can actually print this out from home. Right now, printing out from home is like anyone can really do it, but back then it wasn't quite as much of a thing. So people would essentially be paying me for my time to actually do it, because the stuff that I was making back then was not like anything special in a sense. You know, I was printing on heavy cardstock with an inkjet printer and then cutting it out with like a rotary cutter on my little cutting mat at home. So that was kind of it wasn't anything special, so to speak, when it started out. But as I kept on going, there were some redesigns of some games that we would make. I made a Merchants of Venus redesign that was available before it got reprinted by Fantasy Flight, and that involved a lot of stickers on wood discs. And essentially, if you don't want to sticker 300 little wood discs, then you could pay someone else to do it. And as a 16-year-old, I was very happy for the extra money. So that was kind of my thing. I was very particular about, you know, how precise everything was and how, you know, how it all had to look really good. And so I think that was part of it too. Now we really have a lot more automated machinery, a lot bigger printers. Our quality is a lot higher, and the stuff that we produce now is on par with a lot of other print-on-demand stuff that other companies make too. But it's been a slow, you know, a slow time coming to all of that.
Yeah, just thinking, as you're saying, as a 16-year-old, you have a lot of time and not a lot of money, so being able to do a job like this is probably great.
Yeah, no, and it was great because, you know, I didn't have to leave home. I could just do everything from home. I went to the post office probably multiple times a week. I went there and I stood in line and I mailed my packages, and that was just kind of a thing that I did. Oftentimes, like, I would bike over to the post office if I couldn't borrow the car, and so it was very much a different thing than it is now.
So, how long were you doing it at that level before you bothered to upgrade? I mean, at that time, was it a full-time job or was it just a thing you were doing on the side? Did you plan on growing it at that time or did that just happen naturally?
Yeah, it mostly just happened naturally. It started out just with me, and then I employed some of my siblings, and then some friends from church, and they would come on over and help me make games and cut out boards and cut out, boxes and things like that. At the time, I was still going to a school, and so I was doing school full time, and I was running the business full time, and eventually I was like, basically trying to do both of those things full time wasn't quite working out. My school was suffering a little bit. Work wasn't great as I kept on getting behind because orders just kept on coming in. And eventually I decided that I liked doing what I was doing, and I wanted to do that full time. So that was kind of the switch right there, where I finished up school with a basic 2-year degree and said, hey, yep, I'm good with college and I want to continue doing this. But yeah, it definitely wasn't something that back when I was 16, I was like, hey, what would be cool? It would be cool to, have 10, 10 full-time employees. And it was a very different thing back then, because back then I was doing everything. And now with all the employees that I have, I'm taking much more of a backseat in terms of the actual production of the games. I still oversee that, and I still, am at the office, but I'm not actually making the games like I was 10, 8 years ago or so.
Do you miss having that hands-on experience, or are you happy to have other people to help with it?
Yes. I enjoy doing both. I really love coming to work every day. When Monday rolls around, I'm like, yes, I'm excited to get out of bed and go to work. For me right now, my work is often just rolling out of bed and going over to my remote setup at home. But I enjoy that every day is different. Every day is a new project. Every day there's going to be new challenges to handle, whether that's, the machinery breaks, or troubleshooting paper this, or working on employee skills, or pretty much any of that. It's a lot harder. I really do enjoy just the simple making of the games, but would I go back and do just that? Probably not. Right now, I'm pretty much getting that fixed by doing some woodworking things at home, and so that's kind of my hands-on thing that I still enjoy doing. So.
Yeah, I know. It's like making a prototype. It's kind of a nice meditative thing. Sometimes you can just relax and turn your brain off, watch a show, and still feel like you're getting stuff done. But it's definitely a tedious thing to do. So, at what point did Add Magic acquire you? And how? I mean, whatever you can talk about, obviously, if any of it's private information. But did they approach you? Were you looking for a buyer, or how'd that work out?
Yeah, it just all kind of ended up working out, so to speak. I had been actually printing prototypes for Ad Magic clients for about a year, and I had met Sherry, the owner of Ad Magic, and she was very impressed with the work that we were doing, and she was like, "Hey, I want you to come work for me." And I was like, "Great, but I have a company. What am I going to do with that?" And so she said, "Hey, how about I just buy your company, and then you can continue doing what you're doing." So that was kind of the in short of it. And I was, as trying to recall time frames back then, but yeah, it was. I was very excited that, like, wow, like something that I made, someone is actually interested in paying me money for. This is really cool. And at that point, I was like, is this? I had been running it full time, and I was kind of considering, like, is this something that I actually want to continue doing, or do I want to take a step back? And this was the perfect match of, I can continue doing it, but it's not going to be fully mine in terms of all the risk is not going to be mine anymore, and I don't have to worry about, like, oh, if this thing fails, then my entire livelihood is gone. And it was a nice compromise to be able to basically continue doing what I have been doing for so long, but also basically not have as much risk associated with myself with that. So, but yeah, we ended up signing the papers back in February of, I want to say it was 2015, but
So a while ago still.
somewhere back there.
So yeah, I mean, it's definitely nice having a bigger company absorb a lot of the risk. And so along with that, did they also expand your reach? I mean, I know Add Magic, and now they have Breaking Games too, and they're a pretty far-reaching company in the industry. So did that increase your clients, and is that why you brought on more employees, or how did that change once you got bought, I guess?
Right. It was good for both of us, because essentially now, if someone wanted a bigger run of games, right? They had made their prototype, and now they are ready to actually run their Kickstarter, and they needed a partner for that. I could refer them to Add Magic, but then also vice versa. Add Magic would get a lot of clients that just needed one or two prototypes, but they needed someone to actually refer them to, and so they could then refer them to me. So it was a good partnership because it allowed us both to have someone who did what the other person did not do as well.
Yeah, so definitely sounds like it worked out pretty well so far.
Yeah.
Do you guys still have the, 48-hour turnaround policy?
Yes, that is still active on our site right now, yeah.
So how do you manage that? Because that seems like a pretty tight schedule if you get a lot of jobs in. Or is there any sort of limit on it? Or is it just you're not at the point where you're getting more jobs than you can handle in that time frame?
It's a good question. So in the fine print, we actually changed it from a 48-hour guaranteed turnaround time about a year ago or so. And so in our fine print for the 48-hour turnaround time, what it says is that we're up to like 96% of all orders that are placed on our site go out within 48 hours. And so that's 2 business days after your order is placed. So if you place your order on Monday, it'll go out on Wednesday. And so that gives us one day to essentially double check your files, make sure everything's good, everything's within spec. And then we'll basically one day to print, and then we'll ship out that same day.
I mean, that's still really impressive getting, I can't get one game done in 2 days. So it's very impressive that you can keep that going for multiple clients.
Yeah. One of the things that we do is we basically, one of the reasons why our prices are a little bit higher than some other people is that we offer way more customizations that are available. And so whether it's custom boards, custom boxes, we can do literally any size box, any size board, any size card, any shape card, any shape token, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we can do all of that. And so that's one of the reasons why the prices are a little bit higher. The other reason is we keep a little bit of extra staff on hand to make sure that, if a bigger order does come in, we can actually get that order out and still maintain, making sure that all of our orders are going out on time. Because what we have also available on the website is that we have a rush processing as well. And so if you need to order faster than our normal 48-hour turnaround time, we actually just had a client that we...
That just seems greedy.
Sometimes if you need it, you need it. Just last week, actually, we printed 1,000 poker decks with tuck boxes for a client that needed it. We printed all those decks in 12 hours.
Wow.
So that was one of the bigger things that we've done in that kind of time frame. But we can essentially pivot and do like, all right, we can do like a really big run, or we can, make sure that all the orders are going out on the 48-hour turnaround time.
So what kind of space are you in? You said you just started this at your home, but I imagine you must be in some sort of office space at least to be able to run that many cards.
Yes, we have pretty much upgraded our office space. Pretty much almost every year or so we've added on more space. Currently right now we have about 2,500 square feet of office space and then another 2,500 of warehouse space. And so that's essentially all the space that we have to actually run all the equipment, have the extra storage that we have, et cetera, et cetera.
And also beyond doing the custom printing, I mean, I usually go to you guys for just getting wooden bits because you have the widest selection of shapes and colors that I have seen.
Yeah. No, we have pretty much anytime that like someone wants a new size, usually we'll just order a bunch of that size and then we'll have that size in stock for the next, for the next few years. I can point to most of the exact projects that basically spawned off why we actually added in a particular bit. And so some of the random bits that we have were like, oh, because customer A wanted that, and then we added in that to the website. So
just you grow basically as people need things, and that's a new thing. You just add it, and then other people see it. They want it too. You sell more of it, and it just keeps growing naturally over the years.
Yeah, yeah. We've recently added in doing laser cut things, and so we're actually working on testing some custom meeples. So like basically, you know, any size, any shape meeple with whatever coloring you want. And so we're trying to get that to fit in our 48-hour turnaround time as well. That'll probably be like one extra day or something like that. But
to a custom shape and custom color?
Yep. Probably the custom color is going to be within reason. Like, you know, you probably can't get, you know, forest dark green, but we'll have a green option and a blue option and, you know, a whole bunch of options that will be available for that. So we're always trying to experiment with new things, whether it's custom shapes or custom finishes. We have a synthetic stock that we added in that's like a waterproof stock. So anyways, we have all the different types of things that you may or may not need for your project right now, but there might be something that you might need something similar for. So
I know beyond just doing the print play work, you also support a bunch of different events. I know you've done prizes for the Board Game Workshop Design Contest and the Design Day we did. You send out bits and coupons and stuff. So just wondering if you want to talk a bit about that process and how you go about helping all sorts of different events.
Yeah. So we'll often go to, again, before all of the COVID stuff, we went to a fair number of shows per year. And I always like to be there in person to be able to actually play test games and support the designers that way. But for all the shows that we can't go to, we will support by sending blank cards, blank tokens, extra bits that we have, and then occasionally like coupon codes, cards, sample packs, pretty much all the things that you might need, like they're at the show. Almost every Protospiel type event that I've been to, someone has come up to me and said, hey, you know, I need, you know, 10 blue cubes, or I need a custom die this, right? And sometimes we can say, yes, we happen to bring that particular bit for you. Great, right? Because they need that for the prototype right then and there. And then we also try to make sure that we can take care of people after that too, right? With the coupon codes and saying, hey, you know, if you go to our site, you know, you get, you know, 10% off your order or something like that.
It's been a big help. I know it. The free bits really go over well at the design days, and obviously people love prizes, so no one's going to turn it down.
Free stuff is great. That was pretty much how I started. That I was 16 and I had just bought my first computer, and I had no money, but people had posted free games that you could download, and I was all about that. And so that was kind of my first intro to that. I was like, wow, like I don't have any money, but free is good. So, yeah.
Who knew free games would start your whole career?
It's true, though.
So, in addition to print and play, you're also a game designer, and you just had Flick Wars published. Is that your first design?
Yeah. I've been a part of the design team to some extent for some other projects, but Flick Wars is really the main one that I was a part of from the very beginning.
How did it start? I mean, if anyone has seen pictures, though, it's a massive neoprene mat. You're flicking pieces all over the place. The box is kind of absurd, and it looks like a really interesting game, like great production value, which obviously you know something about production value. So just where did the whole thing start? Because I know you've been working on it for a while.
Yeah, so it's been a work in progress for about 7 years now. It actually, surprise, surprise, started out as a free print and play game. And I saw the game. It wasn't my original design, but I saw the game, and it's called Battle for Gladarion, and by Sean Austin. And I saw it, and I really liked dexterity games, and I said, hey, you know, I would love to make this game a reality. And 7 years ago, I really had no idea what that actually meant, but I was pretty excited about it. So he was like, yeah, let's do it. And I just started playtesting from there and making up new, you know, new bits and ideas for it. And I was young. I hadn't really played a lot of games, but I liked making new things. And this was kind of a way for me to do that. What it is now is definitely much more a result of, like, you know, I played a thousand different games, I understand a little bit of how a rule book is supposed to read, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm very happy with how it turned out now. But the core essence of the game is that it's a tactical dexterity game. It comes with a 2-foot by 2.5-foot mat inside the box, rolled up. Again, one of the things that bugged me about dexterity games is that occasionally the playing surface wasn't ideal. And when I played a dexterity game, like, that's kind of, like, that's part of the experience, and I really wanted that to be a good part of the experience, not like, oh, the mat's folded up, now there's kind of a ridge, and now the game, you know. Not the game is bad, but just it just sort of made me a little sad inside. So I was like, no, my game is not going to have that. I'm going to make my game like I want a dexterity game to be made. And so you now have this big, big whopping box that basically doesn't fit on any game shelf whatsoever. So, which, you know, it is now...
It makes it stand out.
Very obvious, right? Exactly. So.
Well, no, but I mean, the mat's great because I played like a pitch car. And if you don't have the tracks lined up perfectly, you just get slight little bump and it shoots you right off the edge.
Yeah. I play in... we do pitch car tournaments at like BGGCon, and, you know, we spend half the time setting up the track and then half the time shipping the track to actually make it, you know, actually work right. So it's kind of a pain.
Yeah.
But one of the unique things about Flick Wars is that it has a 3D terrain element. And so with the neoprene mat inside the box, you also get a whole bunch of these 2.5-inch wood domes. And so you can place those on top of the map or underneath the mat. And then you actually get that surface that has bumps in the mat, but it's actually intentional. And you can do some really cool shots with that, but it also doesn't detract from the actual gameplay of it, right? You have a perfectly smooth hill, and so you can do a whole bunch of like fun things, right? It's like, all right, you know, there's this obstacle in the way, but there's this hill right here. If I can bank around the hill, I can actually get in range and attack, and it opens up a whole new variety of different things. And I'm kind of just waiting for other dexterity games to actually copy that and actually do the same thing, because it really just adds a whole new level, no pun intended, to the actual gameplay. So
yeah, no, it definitely sounds like it, because like obviously flicking stuff on a flat surface is all well and good, but it's not very interesting. But adding the hills seems like you could do a lot of really interesting stuff. You said originally this was going to be a free print and play, or was a free print and play.
Yeah.
And obviously that has changed with a neoprene mat, and what people can do with the print and play are very different. So what was the original vision, and then what were some of the steps along the way until it got to where it is today?
Yeah, so the original, it started out as a free game, which is pretty much how I found it. You know, I was downloading a whole bunch of free games from Board Game Geek. I found the game and I was like, yep, this is great. And the idea was to pretty much have it to be published in some sort of a fashion. We were kind of bouncing around the idea of like little two-player packs of like, all right, you know, this one has these two factions and you combo it with this one, which has two different factions. And so we kind of bounced around a lot of like, how are we going to actually make this a thing? But we eventually just decided, rather than trying to, you know, piecemeal out the different things, just to throw everything in one box and say, hey, this is everything Flick Wars. It's going to be awesome. Boom. You should buy it. So it started out with, like, I think, like, six different types of units. And we've kind of kept that same flavor in a sense. But right now we have six unique factions, and each of them has 11 different unique units. And so every unit in the game is different, but similar to, let's say, Magic, where you have, let's say, keywords, right? You don't have to memorize 66 different types of units. The same keyword is going to be on several different types of guys. So,
yeah.
But yeah, one of the things that I really worked on with the game was really making sure that the balance was right. And that's one thing, let's say, in a card game or a board game where you have like a limited number of, like, you know, this piece can go in slot A, B, or C, right? Where there's a limited number of things that can happen with that. But one of the interesting things with a dexterity game that you have to balance is, hey, I'm a really good player playing dexterity games. How to balance the fact that I can make this unit better than it actually might be rated as, because I can actually get it to, you know, fit between these two hills, right? And so balancing all that was kind of a pain. And so there actually are certain factions that, let's say, might play better when there's more hills. There are certain factions that might play better when there's more obstacles on top of the mat. And so kind of depending on what factions you're playing with, what units you're using, like what type of terrain that you're using, certain units may or may not be better at those particular times. And so trying to essentially make it as balanced as I could, but also like basically giving each faction units that worked better depending on, let's say, what factions you're playing against, what the terrain type was, et cetera, et cetera. I think that was one of the biggest challenges playing it as a dexterity game.
Now it's finally done. So this seems like a pretty massive undertaking, and it's from Breaking Games now, right? Which is owned by Ad Magic. So how did that come about? Is it something you submitted to them, or is it because you already work for them? It was already like a first writer refusal kind of thing, or how did the choice for them to publish it come about?
So we have on the box, there's Breaking Games and the Print and Play logo. It's technically published by Print and Play, but Breaking Games, because it's part of that same brand, they essentially, we have their logo on the box too, because they have, you know, better distribution deals, et cetera, et cetera. So it's basically technically published by Print and Play, but Breaking Games now has it as one of their titles as well. So we pretty much did, like, I pretty much did all the development myself with my team here, but Breaking Games just, you know, can sell it as well. They'll take it to shows with them and sell it and get it into those all the proper channels and all that good stuff. So,
and I assume it was produced by Ad Magic, right?
That is correct, yes.
And I know Ad Magic loves to take on challenging productions, like they did the cloth mat and stuff for Dragoon. So I imagine that a giant box with a neoprene mat in it was something Sherry really wanted to do.
Yeah, no, it was. It definitely had a lot of little components of, like, oh, you know, this thing has to be exactly like this, and this thing has to be exactly like this. And thankfully, the biggest issue really was the neoprene mat. We had to go through a couple of samples to really make sure that the neoprene mat was a really solid component. But I really like the finished product. I'm very picky about, you know, how things all work together and fit together, but it looks great. And yeah, I couldn't be happier with the final production value of that. So
is it for sale right now? Can people order it, or is it on its way? Or
it is for sale right now. We did the Kickstarter fulfillment, and then we threw it out to the regular market. So it's available for sale in some local game stores and the Breaking Games website, the Print and Play website, at least for right now. So
awesome. Well, I'll definitely have the links to that in the show notes. So we are closing in on the end of the show. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we close it up?
Yeah, I have been on my list is to sign up for the Board Game Workshop Design Contest. And so actually, I wanted to kind of hear a little bit more about that and what would be what kinds of things that a prototyping company can help with to basically help people get their games ready for that.
Most of the contest takes place online, so it's
for sure.
The first two, the biggest help is judging. So if anyone wants to judge, head over to theboardgameworkshop.com and sign up as a judge, because we need a lot of people for that. But I know the first year, you guys donated coupons for the five finalists so they could get stuff to make their prototypes. And in the second year, I stepped back from doing prizes because it ended up being a logistics nightmare with trying to organize the prizes and get in touch with people. But that's probably the biggest help for this kind of thing, because it's the final round is physical prototypes. So getting something together, having them be able to get the bits, I think that was very helpful for the finalists in that first year. But mostly just spreading the word. This contest relies a lot on just people donating some time and helping out with the judging and the entries. And I'm hoping to get more this year, but with COVID messing up a lot of schedules, I could have a lot more people because they have more free time, or a lot less people because they're distracted and busy with other things. So we'll see how it goes.
I'm hoping for a lot more. We had about a month of people who were just, you know, like, hey, we need to kind of figure out what's going on, but we're kind of back up to our normal flow at this point. And I'm thinking that a lot of people are like, yeah, you know, we're at home. We're going to be working on our games, because back when things start to reopen back up, we can start actually getting those games played and on Kickstarter and all that good stuff. So
yeah, it's putting a lot of issues in a lot of people's schedules. I know, like, Origins shifted to October now is the real Origins, but they're doing Origins online. Gen Con is canceled. It's like everything's up in the air.
Did Gen Con actually cancel?
I thought I heard it did. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't go to Gen Con either way. So. Okay. But yeah, I know Unpub was supposed to be the end of May. That got pushed to August, which who knows if things will actually happen in August. So I think there's going to be a really, really messed up schedule. And then the fall, if things are allowed to open, is going to be really, really busy for people that have to go to a lot of conventions.
Yeah. You know, I have signing up for to be a judge is on my list. I have not done it yet, but I've done a lot of playtesting for other people's games, and I'm always excited to do that, because, you know, just seeing what people have out there, you know, every game is different, and actually doing that is one of the ways that I can give back and be like, all right, you know, we're helping actually make more games come out. So I continue doing that today, doing playtesting of stuff, and so this is one of the ways that hopefully I can help give feedback and basically get more games out there. So I am excited for that as soon as I actually throw my name in the hat officially.
Yeah, we get a lot of interesting stuff. And so last year I opened it up to designers of any age. The first year, because I had the prizes, I didn't want to deal with anyone under 18 and issues of that nature. But once I got rid of the prizes, I figured there's no reason not to give feedback to anyone. So last year we got, I think it was 7 games that were at least co-designed by kids.
Oh, and nice. Yeah.
And this year we actually have one kid has already signed up as a judge. He's the son of a friend of mine who was one of the judges the last 2 years, and he's a local designer. So he's actually our first under 18 judge, which again was another thing I was hesitant of earlier on, but I'm making the contest as public as possible. So as long as it's okay with their parents or guardian, they can be a judge, they can enter, they can get feedback, they can be a member of the game design community and learn and grow. So it's been very interesting, all of these different things we get in the contest.
That's awesome. Yeah. That was, I mean, and that's essentially how I started out doing that in small ways. And my parents were very, very supportive of me just, you know, getting out there, and, you know, they were like, oh, you're getting all these packages in the mail and you're corresponding with all these people online. But they were very supportive of that. And that's why I am where I am today, because they, you know, they allowed me to, you know, get out there and do that and be a part of that community. So I'm really glad to hear that it's open for everybody to participate in that. So that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked in schools for the last 15 years. Oh, it's been that long. So I'm used to working with kids anyway. And like, I know how creative they can be, and they can bring entirely new perspectives to things. So it was just for, you know, fear of any legal problems, but I like working with kids. They're great. They have great ideas. So being able to welcome them into the contest has been positive, and I hope we get more. And if anyone's listening that runs game design classes or anything, I do free entries for high school students or middle school or elementary. So just contact me and we can sort that out if you want to get some free entries for your class or your students.
Awesome. Very cool.
Well, I think that pretty much brings us to a close. So are there any, I know projects are kind of on hold for a lot of people, but are there any projects you're working on? I doubt there's any places you're going to be showing up in person in the near future, but any other shows or podcasts you plan on being on?
Not off the top of my head right now. Mostly it's just kind of getting back into a good routine and making sure that my schedule is still good with the remote work and things that I'm doing. But I'm kind of just, you know, now that Flick Wars is finally done, I'm kind of batting around the idea of like, hey, you know, like that that was fun. Like, do I kind of want to get back into doing that again, making a game? And I had previously banned myself from actually doing anything of the sort until my first game was done. But now I'm kind of
That's a good plan. Force yourself to commit.
Exactly. Took me 7 years to actually get it done, but it's done now. So thanks a lot, Chris, for having me on. And
yeah, thanks for coming on.
I'm here to talk about the things that I am passionate about. So that was cool.
And you want to just end it with contact info, websites where they can get your game, if you're on Twitter, Facebook, whatever.
Yeah, so we have our website is printplaygames.com, and you can find all of our prototypes, templates, and all of our things there. We have an Instagram and a Twitter and a Facebook, and you can see pictures and communicate with us there as well. Facebook is printplaygames, and Twitter is printplay, and Instagram is printplaygames. So yeah, all the social medias, reach out to us. We also have a phone line as well if you need to call us and actually talk to us in person as well. So all the ways to get a hold of us.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for coming on the show and sharing all that information. And it was really an interesting story of how you got started, because I knew pieces of it from just seeing stuff online, but I didn't realize you started that young.
Yeah, it's. I think most people when they met me in person back then were like, oh, you sounded a lot older online. It's like, yeah. So, worked out nicely in my favor there.
That's all for this episode. Financial support for the Board Game Workshop is provided by our annual game design contest and our Patreon supporters. Special thanks to our inventor level supporters, Vas Kadas, Roscoe Shock, Brad Batchelor, and Chris Turner. If you would like to support the show, go to patreon.com/theboardgameworkshop. You can contact the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Discord. Go to theboardgameworkshop.com for links, past episodes, and information about our design contest and other events. Thanks for listening.